Hey, everybody. Joe here from the Lions Led by Donkeys podcast, but I guess you probably already knew that. What if there was a war raging for a million years, but it was kept a secret? It's a question that Sarkis never considered. He's born as an upper middle class man living in Prime City during the so-called millennia of peace. As far as he knew, or as far as anybody knew, humanity has no army, no weapons, and no wars. The people of Earth had been expanding into the stars as long as anyone remembered, free of conflict, while the Techno King and his royal cabal enriched themselves in the backs of their labor. It was as it always had been. Then, Sarkis died. Unbeknownst to him, an app he used every single day of his life hijacks his consciousness and uploads it into a synthetic engine of war known as a sleeve. Along with countless others, he's been conscripted into the Undying Legion, charged with fighting a secret, unending war in the name of humanity. Their minds stolen, uploaded into war machines, they fight a secret war to preserve humanity. My new book, The Invisible War, is now available wherever it is that you consume books. If you have Kindle Unlimited, you can get it for free with your subscription that you already have, or order a paperback from whatever local bookstore you use. If you like what we do here on the show, consider supporting us on Patreon at www.patreon.com/lionsledbydonkeys. Just $5 per month gets you every regular episode early, access to our community Discord, a digital copy of my book, The Hooligans of Kandahar, as well as its audiobook, read by me, and over 5 years of bonus content. By supporting the show, you support us and allow us to keep our show, as it has always been, ad-free. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoy the show. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to the Lions Led by Donkeys podcast. I am Joe, and with me, plumbing the depths of the content cave in London, is Tom. Sup, buddy?
I'm so excited to talk about guys in China.
Oh, we're going to talk about many different kinds of guy today. All of them bad.
Is there any other type of guy we talk about on this show?
Rarely. I'm going to say like a tops 5%.
I mean, like, they're either, like, freaks like Himmler, or they're, like, people like Adrian de Weert, who is just like, oh, what if the Terminator was, like, Belgian?
Yeah, and, like, even the guys we talk about who are cool kind of suck, with the exception of very few of them. You know, the word that that we often see is eccentric, which is a nice broad painting that's like, oh, look, they did these really cool things, but also... Oh, God, don't look here, you know?
Yeah, don't look, don't put in their name and then parentheses anti-Semitism after anyone we talk about.
Yeah, or it's like Ord Wingate, who is like kind of cool, and then I was like, oh, what's this? He started a death squad, multiple death squads. It's like, ugh, God damn it. You're almost cool. Instead, you are a monster.
If you take anything away from this show, it is that we should abolish private education.
Kinda, yeah. I mean, it's certainly a bullet point. I feel comfortable saying.
Yeah, it's in the long list of things we're abolitionists about.
And then there's, you know, the monsters who are comically, hilariously interesting. And then as you plumb further, it's just like, I can't laugh at this anymore. Like Bokassa, yeah. Or, you know, Baron Sternberg, who is legitimately one of the worst people we've ever done a series about.
Listen, like, obviously for you listening at home, me and Joe talk a lot about like what series we're going to cover and everything, and the other long series we're doing this year, there's going to be no laughs, so I am gonna
yucks are strictly prohibited.
Yeah, so I'm gonna enjoy talking about weird guys who are doing period blood Wing Chun today.
So, when we left you last time, we're here on the Boxer Rebellion Part 3. So, you know, if you're just tuning in now, maybe go back and listen to Part 1 and 2, or don't. You know, if you want to just start smack dab at you know, 55% into a series, be my guest. But when we left you last week, the international delegation became trapped in their quarter in Peking. Now, of course, Beijing. Reinforced less than 500 soldiers and began digging in as the Boxers tightened their grip on the Chinese capital city. And then the German minister to China grabbed a suspected Boxer child off of the street and executed him.
Hey, listen, it's probably the maybe the least worst thing an ambassador has ever done to a small child.
Especially a German one in Imperial China. There's no, I'm not looking into that any further. We don't need to, in fact.
Yeah.
Oh, it's like, you know, it's always a kid. It's very funny. Like in a small place like, you know, Georgia or say Armenia, where you just will meet ambassadors in the strangest places because it's a small country. All the embassies are in one small place, and it's just like, you know, the ambassador of Norway played bar trivia with a couple friends of mine in Yerevan. It's just like, you got the yin and the yang of the ambassadors.
Like, what would be the funniest place to be sent as an ambassador to?
I think one of those places, it's like, you know, a sovereign nation, but only for, like, tax purposes. Like, you know, you've struggled your whole way up, like, say, the American Department of State to get an ambassadorial role. And, like, you're going to Luxembourg or San Marino or something. It's like, all right, I guess.
I was going to say you get sent to Transnistria.
I feel like the only ambassador there is Russian. it's like I am the American ambassador to Abkhazia. It's like being a pretender to the throne, or that crazy homeless guy I believe in San Francisco to declare himself the emperor of the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just going to drive across the border into Abkhazia from Tbilisi, almost certainly be detained. And then just like, no, you don't understand. I'm the American ambassador, to Abkhazia. You have to let me in.
Yeah. Like, I think like this period as well is like, this is the real peak of being an ambassador, because like, there's really no like international law, and every ambassador is just like a weird freak. Like, people probably think of like, oh, you know, the 1950s or 60s. No, that's baby shit. Send me back to this time.
Definitely during like the imperial period, where like communications between the embassy or the state ministers, like what they called ambassadors back then, were not instantaneous back to their home country. So it gave them much more leeway to just be deeply weird freaks and do whatever they wanted. And speaking of weird freaks, word quickly spread about what the German minister had done, you know, executing a child in the German embassy. And like, when I say child, like, nobody's sure how old this guy was, but it's generally thought, like, everybody that says that he looked like a teenager. So child, you know?
He's the nepo baby of like some weird German baron.
I mean, he literally was German nobility. and the German noble who like executed this this kid, no other ministers liked him. Like we talked about before, like everybody thought he was kind of brash and, you know, an asshole who brushed off everybody else's concern again about, you know, again shooting a man in the basement of his embassy.
Hey, the Germans are still sending former nobility to be you know, political actors on the global stage. Looking at you, Ursula von der Leyen. You can't be called von der Leyen anymore. They got rid of hereditary titles.
Yeah, famously a woman who cares deeply about the people of the Caucasus. I can tell you from that, from experience. What's that? I'm getting an email. She's deeply concerned. Okay.
Yeah, she is very concerned about sending, you know, cool GoPro drones to the Caucasus.
Yeah, specifically to one country in the Caucasus.
She just wants to create a content economy in the Caucasus of really cool GoPro footage of drone races.
I'm going to do a YouTuber face as like this, like Azeri drone zooms in on my position to drop a fucking like, I don't know, an EU manufactured missile on my face.
Mr. Beast doing a collab with the EU. We give 100 drones to Azerbaijan.
Oh, I'm having a horrible idea here. Azeri, oh. Mr. Beast.
Oh God, that probably exists. Listen.
If it exists, he's in a political prison in Baku.
I was gonna say he's probably gonna be the next prime minister, but
oh no, that is hereditary in that country, unofficially, much like North Korea. So word quickly spreads out about this extrajudicial killing in the basement of the German embassy, and soon thousands of boxers, as well as many elements of the Chinese Imperial Army, were riding through the city. At this point, any Chinese person still found within the walls and not on the boxers' side was seen as a convert, as an enemy, and was, you know, that along with anybody who looked vaguely foreign. And not only people, but buildings, churches, temples, houses, and shops that were ran by converts or owned by foreigners were torched. And anybody who fell into the hands of the Boxers were cut to pieces real slow-like. Yeah. You know, it's not a good way to go.
Yeah, this sort of thing, like, is just the wet dream of, like, neo-pagan teenagers in, like, Scandinavia in the 90s.
Yeah, thankfully they just are weird losers in dark clubs.
Varg Vikernes is, like, a huge fan of the Boxer Rebellion.
God, he probably is.
He's on TikTok now, which is really weird.
This is the least surprising thing I've heard all day.
We
love our social media platforms that allow neo-Nazi murderers to have free reign.
Like, literally, like, a man who went to prison for murder and is an avowed and very public neo-Nazi for the past 30 years is just, like, showing you how to play Burzum riffs on fucking TikTok.
Teaching you how to do neo-Nazi guitar riffs on TikTok, yeah. I mean, he's one of a thousand doing that. He just happens to be the only, I assume, convicted neo-Nazi murderer who killed his own bandmate.
Yeah, listen, in the same vein of fascist musicians, R.I.P. Toby Keith.
Yeah, Kris Kristofferson's still alive, baby.
Oh, that article was so funny of, like,
Toby Keith told Kristofferson, like, he told him, like, none of that leftist shit.
Yeah, and then he was like, oh, you know, Toby Keith is like what Waylon Jennings said about pantyhose did to finger fucking.
People within the protected legation quarter watched as thousands of torch-bearing Boxers marched into the city in the middle of the night chanting, kill, kill. Which, you know, good for optics if you're the Boxers, which, like, to be fair, remember, they're entertainers, they're presenters. They got their, you know, choreographed fighting, like, shows. They have their, you know, their rituals and stuff. So they know the value of a good look, which I can respect about them.
Yeah, it's strong, consistent messaging. You know, they have a message. It's nice and condensed. I remember when I was a teenager, I saw, when I was like 12, in my very small hometown in this like shitty theater, I went and saw a troupe of Shaolin monks.
Hell yeah.
They did like, you know, martial arts displays and stuff on stage. It was so cool. And I'm just like, I know these guys aren't, you know, Shaolin monks, but I'm just imagining them like doing elaborate martial arts displays in the public squares.
But they do it in like Dublin. try to recruit Irish members of the Boxers, which I am almost certain exists. Just like the Taiping Heavenly Kingdom, there's like two Irish guys like, this is pretty cool.
Yeah, it's just like, you know, the way Falun Gong people are always in the square in Amsterdam.
Yeah, they are. Yeah. I just like the idea of you touring like a Boxer village. All the Christian places are burnt down. Foreigners are all gone. And then there's an Irish pub in the middle of all of it.
Probably. Like, look, you know, Irish
pub. I put on the red sash. They're cool with me.
Hey, it's red. It's not orange. That's all I'm going to say. Yeah, like, Irish pubs pop up everywhere because, like, Irish pubs, I think the number is, like, on average between, like, 12 and 17% more revenue. So it's, like, hence why there's an Irish pub in Yerevan.
There's one in Tbilisi as well. I believe Yerevan is two now, which is interesting, yeah.
We're multiplying. We're like algae.
The Irish mold.
Green mold, baby.
Now, as the legation members looked on in horror, individuals decided, like, as a group, they weren't going to do anything. But individuals ran out to save people who were trying to run from the Boxers, to include a group of American Marines who left their position and decided they're going to do some freelance work. And they saw Boxers pushing converts into a church, and then they were trying to set it on fire. So the Marines ran out and fought them off and saved 300 people from being burned to death. And then they had to run from the church back into the legation quarter in a running gun and sword battle with Boxers, which is the most Marine thing they could possibly do. And after this happened, like, thousands upon thousands upon thousands of refugees are getting into the legation quarter because, they won't be murdered immediately, at least. And when French and Russian soldiers ran out to do the same thing, they were too late. And this is the scene that they saw. Quote, women and children hacked to pieces, men trussed up like fowls with noses and ears cut off and eyes gouged out. Many were found roasted alive and so massacred and cut up to be unrecognizable. The stench of human blood in the hot June air was almost intolerable, and the sights more than we could bear. Men, women, and children lay indiscriminately heaped together, some hacked to pieces, others with their throat cut from ear to ear. Some were still moving.
And this is where all the jokes stop.
Oh, yeah. This, from part three on out, it gets, let's call it real boxery. And then part five is like, ah, yes, Europeans are involved. At the Austrian mission, which was still within the quarter, Boxers charged their defenses, and the Austrian soldiers let loose with their brand new Maxim machine guns. And this is where you assume, like, boxes are going to be laid to the waist, like, you know, a scythe through wheat, right?
Yeah.
Machine guns versus swords. They hit nothing. The soldiers were not trained at all on how to actually use the machine gun. Now, like, what we see machine guns now is, you know, free-wielding, belt-fed weapons that you just aim as you go, right? Maxim machine guns in the day, and many would, even through World War One, they have an aiming device called, like, a T&E, where you have to raise and lower it in order to hit things, and you have to be able to aim and know how to aim with your assistant gunner and your gun crew. The Austrians didn't know how to do that, and they aimed way too high, which resulted in them blowing apart telegraph wires.
Like, you have a massive group of people rushing towards you, and you can't even hit that.
Yeah, you'd assume that you just, hey, you see that screaming guy with a spear? Just aim over there. And, you know, recon by fire, you know, aim it in, because it's a machine gun. You can just hold down the trigger. But thankfully, I guess for the Austrians, the rattle of machine gun fire going right over the head of the Boxers was enough to send them running. However, it did have a secondary effect. Remember, the Boxers believe that they're impervious to gunfire. So, you know, when someone rips off a burst from a machine gun and it, none of them drop dead, they're like, holy shit, it worked.
They got plot armor.
Yeah, they get divine plot armor from their Boxer gods.
Yeah.
Now, outside of all of that, the Boxers were yet to really truly assault the quarter. Instead, they busied themselves with burning foreign establishments and Christians. Though, that didn't stop Kettler, the German minister, from riding around the burning city on horseback with a pistol in each hand, gunning down any Chinese people he saw. He assumed if he saw a Chinese person, they were a Boxer. And remember, there's thousands of people trying to get into the legation for protection. And other ministers were like, what the fuck are you doing? Cut it out. And, you know, that's a stupid fucking thing to do. Not only could the Boxers and or the Imperial Chinese Army kill you with an errant gunshot, but, like, you're shooting innocent people. But he ignored them. Like, he's just like, nah, this is the most fun a German man's going to have in at least 10 years.
My head is in my hands. Why? Just why?
Now, while the capital city burned and thousands, maybe tens of thousands of Boxers ran wild in the street, the imperial government was paralyzed with infighting, indecision, and arguing, and not to mention good old-fashioned factionalism. The Empress Dowager was not really on the side of the Boxers anymore. Shit had simply gotten too real. But other parts of her government were still totally on board. And still others used this opening, this chaos, as an opportunity to power play and try to get the old emperor back on the throne while she maneuvered to pick some dumb fuck man to sit on the throne that would serve her purposes. Now, finally, she was about to issue an imperial decree to order all governors to dispatch their armies towards Peking to put the Boxers down, only for the foreign delegation to demand that the Chinese government surrender the forts at Tietzin, the Taku forts, which we will talk about further in a bit, and allow the free, unlimited passage of military power from Europe and Russia and Japan into Peking, which would, you know, reinforce the delegations, the legation quarter, and crush the Boxers. And to her, this was asking for an invasion, because it kind of was. And the Chinese government took this as a declaration of war. She then told all members of the delegations within the legation quarter, all nations, period, that they must leave Peking within 24 hours. This split the delegation because, remember, they have zero outside communications at all at this point for a week. They had no idea what was going outside of their quarter, if reinforcements were coming or anything else. Several ministers point out, rightfully, if we leave the legation quarter, the Boxers are going to fucking kill us. And the Chinese government almost certainly let it happen. Others said if they didn't leave, the Chinese government and the Boxers would definitely attack the quarter, overwhelm their defenses, and also murder them. The military representatives helpfully pointed out that, like, look, we have a much better chance holding here and defending you than if we leave the legation quarter. Like, we can defend you for a certain amount of time here, but if we just walk out in a parade through Peking, we're fucking dead within an hour. And the soldiers within the legation did their best to better their shitty situation into something, well, not
less shitty.
Yeah, not good. Less shitty. And one of those things was they did was slap together a cannon out of spare parts. Remember when we talked about that the Russians showed up and they were supposed to bring the artillery, but they had forgotten
it.
They did bring the ammunition. So they found an old Chinese imperial gun barrel. It was like a bronze gun barrel. The Italians had some busted up wagon wheels with them. They're like, okay, let's put it on top of them. And they put that together with a discarded roof beam and then discovered that the Russian ammunition that they had brought worked within this old gun barrel. And they also could hand make, like, you know, flechette canister rounds with debris and bits of metal that would work. And they dubbed this the International Gun, or Old Betsy.
I don't know if this is going to happen, but this feels like a very easy way to blow at least 15 to 20 soldiers to pieces.
It actually worked. This thing.
Oh, fuck.
Yeah, it actually worked. It wasn't a great cannon, but it was better than the singular one that they had. So they doubled the amount of cannons by, you know, inventing a suicide blaster. You know, some orc shit from Warhammer 40K.
they're giving it up to Mork, you know.
they're gonna argue over how exactly much DACA they need.
There's just Germans being birthed out of mushrooms.
And the Russian gun crews, despite being so stupid they forgot their own cannons, were actually quite talented, as were the Japanese, which actually required them to work together, which will really not happen again, but we'll get there. Meanwhile, the ministers decided to buy time. They sent word to the Imperial Chinese government that they would agree to leave, but they would need more than 24 hours. They believed they could kick the can down the road. Maybe some reinforcements will get there or something. Then the Imperial government simply never answered. So von Kettler, the German minister, got sick of waiting, called his sedan chair over for them to bring them down to the Yamen, the Imperial government office set up to deal with foreigners. He's like, carry me over there. I will sit down in front of them and I will refuse to leave until they answer the delegation's letter. This would require him to leave the protected quarter. And everyone in the delegation was like, you probably shouldn't do that. That's stupid. Like, the city is burning around us. People are being hacked down in the street. Maybe don't go out there in your fancy rich guy chair. And he, again, ignored them. As soon as he was out of eyeshot of the quarter, a Chinese army officer, flanked by several soldiers and Boxers, walked over to the sedan chair that was being carried through the street and shot Kettler dead.
Yeah, like, I can't imagine, like, the thinking behind this, that, like, this is not going to, like, they are going to be totally fine as we carry this dignitary through what is essentially enemy lines. And, yeah, this is like, it doesn't really make sense.
I feel like he had that mindset where, like, they wouldn't dream of hurting me because the amount of damage it would bring them.
Yeah.
It didn't matter. And nobody's really sure if he was targeted because of who he was and the reputation that he had, or simply because he was a foreigner being carried out of the quarter and they were killing foreigners. But in the end, it didn't really matter if he was targeted for being the minister or not. I mean, what matters, he was murdered. And with that, any further talk of the delegation leaving the protected quarter was dropped. it was clear that they were not only at war with the Boxers, but unofficially the Chinese government. After the 24-hour period lapsed, the siege of the legation quarter would officially begin. As for the reinforcements that the legation was waiting for, but also had no idea if they were coming or not, they actually were on their way, and they would take their form in what would become known as the Seymour Expedition. Vice Admiral Edward Seymour had received all of those panicked telegrams coming from the delegation since the end of May. Seymour was in command of the British Navy's Chinese detachment, and quickly liaison with the other ally nations' navies who were all off of Tiet Sin. And they decided they would need to try to slap as many men together as possible and try to get them to Peking as soon as possible. Kind of surprisingly, they were all doing this without any real authority from their host nations or where they were from. Specifically, like, Seymour didn't ask London, hey, can I do this? He had sent a request over wire after getting the distress messages from Peking, but decided he wasn't going to wait for a response, knowing that if he did, the people in Peking might be fucked. He managed to scrape together a force of around 2,000 men from 8 different countries, though they were not all soldiers or Marines. Some were, but the nations also emptied their ship of anyone deemed unimportant for the fleet to sit in Tiet Sin. They gave them a gun and told them to give them the landing boats that were heading towards Tiet Sin in general. They also brought nothing heavier than machine guns. There's no artillery, nothing. And Seymour rightfully gets a lot of shit for his expeditions, but in his mind, this was not a military campaign. This was not a military mission. It was something more akin to a humanitarian relief mission. You wouldn't need cannons and artillery trains and things of that nature. However, that also meant he didn't worry too much about virtually any military detail involved in this entire episode. Seymour had no idea that the Boxers had already busied themselves destroying the rail connection between themselves and Peking. He had no idea what was going on. He did no reconnaissance whatsoever. So he stormed the Tiet Sin rail yard and demanded to be allowed to use all of their train cars they had available to transport his men. And when he was told no by the Imperial Chinese train guy, he took them at gunpoint, which is actually not his idea. It was the idea of the American commander, Civil War veteran Bowman McCullough, because they don't name people like they used to.
Yeah, that's really surprising that the American is like, nah, give me the trains or I'll fucking brain you.
Yeah, it's like, wait, I have in this holster on my hip the master key to your train yard.
And then they just get on the trains and they move maybe like 10 kilometers down, you know, down the line. He's like, oh, there's no train anymore. There's no lines.
Hold that thought.
Oh, for fuck's sake.
Now, McCullough and Seymour actually became two quick, fast friends, because who brings friends together? What brings two people together faster than a good old-fashioned train robbery?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I should point out here that Seymour knew at least 20% of what was going on in Peking. He knew about the Boxers, but he had no idea about the Chinese government and what they were doing, specifically that they were working with the Boxers. He didn't wait for approval from the Chinese government to begin his journey, because remember, in our last episode, the Chinese government only allowed as many soldiers as had gotten to the legation, period. Like, the 2,000 people were not going to be allowed to just march through their land and enter Peking. And he was never going to get that approval anyway, so he didn't bother. And the same could be said, this utter state of confusion of the total picture of the situation could be said for Chinese military commanders. Regional Chinese military commanders were getting so many different orders, they weren't sure which ones to follow. For example, when Seymour's train approached a bridge, there was a nearby camp of 4,000 Chinese soldiers, a force strong enough to wipe out his expedition, but their commander had been getting one message one day telling them fight the Boxers, and another telling him to stop the foreigners from getting to Peking, back and forth. So when the train pulled up, he wasn't sure which he was supposed to do, and much more likely, he was beyond the point of giving a fuck, so he just let them go right on by. And this is about as smooth as the journey would go, because at the halfway point between the cities, Seymour ran into the damage that the Boxers had done to the train tracks. He had to stop the train near Liangfeng Station and ordered laborers that he brought with him to get out and fix it. Then hundreds of boxers appeared. According to the soldiers, the boxers jumped up and down, dropped to the ground and faked their deaths, only to leap back up to their feet, swung their weapons around and danced and chanted as they advanced towards them. They are armed with spears, swords, and these giant two-manned muskets called the Jingals that were supposed to be they were made to be mounted on walls and fired in like point defense, but they were carrying them with them over their shoulders and firing them as they went.
That fucking rules. Like, they took the concept of a tandem bike and applied it to weaponry.
Fuck yeah. And imagine getting hit by the musket ball that comes out of that thing. You're just ethered from the waist up.
Yeah, you're getting Napoleon's horse.
Yeah, exactly. It's getting field dressed by a cannonball. And the boxers attacked the Allied lines for the next 5 days. As the soldiers ran off the train to try to form battle lines and laborers attempted to fix the tracks in front of them, Seymour was discovering more and more problems. The boxers had destroyed all the station's water tanks, meaning there was no water for their train engines, a big problem in the 1900s when shit ran on steam and coal. The boxers would charge Allied lines, but right before they made contact, they would drop and start going through the ritual breathing exercises, which was, you know, supposed to make them immune to bullets, which of course gave the soldiers enough time to quickly prove how wrong that belief was. Though this didn't mean the soldiers were holding them off no problem. The boxers were charging at them piece by piece in different locations around the railway, and the way to think about this is they were probing for a weakness. But there's only 2,000 or so soldiers on that railway, and this train stretched back miles because, you know, it's so many different train cars, enough to carry 2,000 people. So in some places on the line, the boxers didn't charge, but would launch sneak attacks in the middle of the night. Now, one of these sneak attacks caught 5 Italian soldiers off guard while they were playing cards, and everybody discovered their fate the next morning when they found bits and pieces of them strewn about the grass.
Jesus Christ.
Then if that wasn't bad enough, the train lost contact with Tientsin because the boxers closed the line behind them and started ripping up train tracks, ripping up telegraph wires, cutting off this train-borne mission. And a scouting mission showed that boxers had done irreversible damage to the train line, both in front of them and behind them. Seymour and McCullough quickly came to the conclusion they needed to withdraw on foot and get back to Tientsin because if they stayed, they were going to be completely cut off, surrounded, and wiped out. And this is only underlined when 5,000 soldiers of the Gansu Braves showed up and began assaulting the train station, working with the boxers. Soon, the expedition began their withdrawal, leaving their trains and anything they couldn't carry directly on their person behind, marching along a nearby river so they couldn't be surrounded, as boxers and imperial troops began to lay dozens of ambushes for them during the day and launched their, at this point, patented night raids.
Mm-hmm. Asymmetrical warfare against a group that know the lay of the land. It's very hard.
Yeah, it's not going to work. The boxers no longer only had swords and spears either. They had been given or stolen a decent amount of guns from either, you know, stolen from European stores or simply given to them from the Chinese imperial government. They weren't exactly well trained in them, but they knew how a gun functioned. They would pop out, fire a few volleys, and run before the soldiers could react. And then when they did this so much and the soldiers were reacting to like immediately just hitting the ground and then trying to form a skirmish line, which would then slow down the full body of men, they learned they could simply jump out, chuck a bunch of like lit firecrackers out, and the popping noise would cause them to react to gunfire and they would haul ass. So they're just constantly harassing them around the clock.
Mm-hmm. They're doing psychological warfare shit.
Yeah, pretty much. It was also June. And they're marching through what was part of the Gobi Desert.
Yep.
So before long, men begin to run out of water and they resort to drinking out of the heavily polluted river they're marching next to. That shit was so nasty that someone called it, quote, brown water at best. This is only made worse by the fact that none of the soldiers were dressed correctly for the weather. The Germans, for example, wearing a thick wool uniform that was issued out to soldiers and sailors bound for North Sea duty.
Yeah. Swamp ass yet again.
Yep. Swamp ass and drinking swamp ass water out of the river.
Swamp inside and out.
It swamps all the way down. And then remember, like, wearing the shitty ass wool uniforms to make you sweat more is to make you hotter. You drink more of the nasty ass swamp water. So nearly everyone is sick before they even cover a small percentage of the 30 miles it would take them to get back to Tientsin. Between the constant attacks from both the boxers and violent bouts of diarrhea, the soldiers only made it 8 miles back towards Tientsin by the time the siege began back at Peking. As they advanced, things only got worse as boxers had occupied every village and town on their way back to Tientsin, meaning if they wanted to keep advancing, half-dead, thirsty, and shit and dust encrusted, they would have to assault through these reinforced villages and towns before they could move forward. This would only slow them down more, not only from attacks, but also from the resulting wounded, which would slow them down, which Seymour was now carrying around hundreds of. And that is when they accidentally stumbled upon a fucking fortress.
What?
Remember, there's no recon done. No reconnaissance whatsoever. Seymour really doesn't have a map. And he was assuming that he's going to do this entire expedition comfortably on a train.
Like, dude, at least send someone forward to do some recon. It's like, okay, we have to fucking march all this fucking way. You can run fast. You go ahead and tell us if there's, you know, a fortress.
You have the least amount of diarrhea. You're now our scout.
Yeah.
You're not going to leave a snail trail of your insides as you go.
Yeah, you're not doing like a real tactical shit because it's like, oh, you just follow the smell and find the spy.
So as they marched, they ran directly into the giant Siku arsenal. Its reinforced walls and battlements just kind of snuck up on them. And it turned out this worked both ways. They had also snuck up on the defenders in the arsenal, because when they showed up outside the gates, neither side knew who the other was. When the Imperial soldiers asked who they were, Seymour, through a translator, answered, quote, "We're friendly." The Imperial army then opened fire on them. Despite momentary chaos of suddenly being shot at by a fortress, the arsenal actually fell with only an hour because it turned out that they were only half-staffed and the Chinese soldiers inside of it were just as surprised as everybody else and not really up for a real fight. Most of them simply ran, abandoning the arsenal to the Allied expedition. Now Seymour's exhausted, starving, thirsty, sick, and wounded soldiers took the fort and, you know, they were shocked to find it was well stocked with everything that they needed. Food, water, medical supplies, all that. Accidentally stumbling onto this fort and having it open fire on them saved the expedition.
It's like, you know, when you're playing a game and you know like a boss battle is gonna happen because you just randomly walk into a room, it's like, oh, there's so much ammo and health packs in here.
Yeah, when you're playing an RPG and you're wandering through a place like, why does this room have a save point? Seymour's standing in the middle of the Gobi Desert as a giant blue question mark is floating off in the distance. He's like, oh no, oh fuck. It's not the kind of save point that that refreshes our health and MP. Now the fort also had artillery, millions of rounds of rifle ammunition, brand new machine guns, everything that they would need, which was good, because as soon as they staffed the fort and took it over, another Chinese army showed up and assaulted them, quickly finding themselves getting shot to pieces and blown up with their own weapons. Though the army reeled back, it was reinforced by thousands of boxers, and they launched attacks all throughout the next day. The boxers made it up over the walls, leading to brutal hand-to-hand combat in one situation where a boxer made his way all the way to the artillery line, only to get blown to mist at point-blank range as they attack the cannoneers. Just like, the cannon goes off, the boxer vanishes, and the only thing left is a sword and a pool of blood.
Yeah, he's just like T-posing, and the sword is floating in the air.
Despite casualties mounting, the expedition held the fortress, but now had so many wounded, they had a different problem. Carrying them all back to Tientsin would be impossible, so they decided not to. And they settled in for a siege as the Chinese army and their boxer friends surrounded the arsenal. But they wouldn't wait for help for too long. Unbeknownst to Seymour, another expedition from Port Arthur had ventured out, made up of thousands of Cossacks under Russian command. And I assume Seymour and everybody else around is like, man, I'm really glad I'm not Jewish right now, because those are Cossacks.
Jesus Christ.
They broke through the encirclement and relieved Seymour and his men, bringing with them food and, most importantly, cigarettes. One British soldier joked that he was happiest of all to see cigarettes because he had been reduced to smoking tea leaves in his pipe.
Hey, listen, you know, morale is very important, and key to that ever-changing forms is tobacco. You know, it used to be, oh, I need, you know, some tobacco for my corn cob pipe. Now it's like, oh my God, we just got a new shipment of, like, Lost Mary vapes.
A Cossack rides up, climbs down, opens his furs, and just shows, like, I have Lost Mary, I have Elf Bar, I have these weird off-brand Russian shits that will make your teeth fall out.
And they're all just varying flavors of kefir. The kefir vape is a terrifying idea.
It's my dairy-based vape. Also, I should point out that a British soldier sitting in China smoking fat bowls of tea leaves is a man so British he's rapidly transforming into just a Union Jack. The only thing missing is a small baggie of cocaine he shares with his friends. Now, we talked briefly before about the Taku forts. They stick out from Tientsin into the ocean and were directly pointed at the Allied fleet, which was mostly British and Japanese at this point. Now that everyone from the Allies to the Chinese accepted that they were pretty much at war without a formal declaration, despite their nobody really knowing why everybody was at war, it was accepted. The Taku forts in Tientsin presented a problem for the Allies. The fleet outside was their only lifeline for the foreign forces within the city of Tientsin, but also Peking. If the Chinese wanted to shut down the bay with the forts and stop any resupply coming ashore, that would be obviously bad. Things only got worse when the Chinese began reinforcing the forts with both regulars and Boxers. So the commanders of the different fleets got together and decided that they would have to be taken, which is really interesting. There was no formal chain of command or structure between the various different allied countries. It was a democracy of admirals.
Okay.
Which normally when those words leave my mouth, it's leading to a military coup, but not in this case. Now, one admiral, Seymour's second command, James Bruce of the Royal Navy, kind of rose to the top of being the ad hoc unofficial commander of the Allied fleet. And this was mostly just due to politics of who was like the other countries would be less against listening to, like, for the first time in history, all these countries, like, I guess the British are the best bet.
Yeah, yeah.
He decided that he would have to take the forts and move what ground forces they had inland to completely take the city of Tientsin. Though I should stop and point out here that Tientsin is kind of split. You have the foreign settlement at Tientsin, which is exactly what it sounds like on the tin, right? Like, it's, and the main city of Tientsin, because the combination of imperial decrees and just good old-fashioned European racism meant that the two cities were separate and largely segregated. And at this point, the democracy of admirals was concerned with securing the foreign settlement at Tientsin. And everyone agreed that this is a good idea, we need to do this, but also we should tell and warn the Chinese, this is what we plan on doing if you don't surrender without a fight first. And every commander, Bruce included, was kind of shocked that everything was working so well at this point between themselves, other than the American commander, a guy named Lewis Kempf. Mm-hmm. Now, this is because he seemed to be the only admiral or a naval officer that had standing orders from his nation to not explicitly go to war without the Chinese doing something first, like whatever was considered an open act of war. But what would count as that was kind of left in the air for him to judge. And Kempf was erring on the side of caution. He didn't want to get in trouble and definitely didn't want to get involved in this bullshit, since to him, no act of war had happened yet. Remember, they don't know what's happening with Seymour and they don't know what's happening in Peking. So it kind of made sense for him to be like, why am I Why am I assaulting this fort? So he struck a middle ground with the rest of the naval commanders. He refused to take part in the direct fort assault, but would station one of his boats close to the rest of the fleet with orders that if they were fired upon, it'd be considered an act of war, which is almost certain to happen because of where the ship would be. So the Allies sent their ultimatum to the Chinese government, which they rejected by way of opening fire on the Allied fleet before the ultimatum time had expired, which... yeah, that'll do it. Though I should point out here again, in all fairness, that the Chinese claim that they were shot at first, which is also likely. We don't know. But we should also point out here, again, that the Allies had a plan to invade a Chinese city, and the Chinese would obviously resist such an action. Either way, they were going to shoot at each other, and someone fired, and the Allies put their plan into effect. Though just because the Allies had a plan did not mean it was a good plan. And in this situation, there wasn't a lot of good option. The Allies would bombard the forts by sea while slowly floating in their invasion force via small rowboats, which would, you know, of course, be in direct gun sights of the Chinese forts, both machine guns and cannons. Kind of like D-Day on a budget.
Yeah, it's like Tommy Wiseau, fucking D-Day. You're just like up on the walls like, there's loads of boats coming in. Should we shoot them?
To be fair, I would watch Saving Private Ryan directed by Tommy Wiseau. That would whip ass. Now, it was pretty known that these landing forces weren't going to have a great time. And that's why each man in the landing party was offered an optional ration of coca leaves to boost their courage.
Yeah! We're getting fucking ripped to the gills on coca leaves.
Yeah. Now, some of you maybe don't know, that is the base plant where cocaine comes from. Also other things, but namely cocaine. So yeah, an invasion force of Brits, Russians, Japanese, Austrians, and Italians all chewing mouthfuls of coca as they floated ashore.
I mean, very accurate to all those nations today.
Yeah. And what's kind of interesting here is I was going to call it and make a joke about, you know, ye olde cocaine. But cocaine had already existed for like 40 years at this point. So when the landing force hit the beach, they found where they landed was kind of a death trap. It was totally smooth, completely flat and open, and offered no cover whatsoever. Also, they learned upon hitting the beach that the Allied fleet bombardment had done virtually no damage whatsoever to the Chinese forts. So the landing party were forced to retreat back to the beach until the fleet could hit the forts again. Then it got dark, meaning nobody could see anything and, of course, aim their cannons for a good bombardment. And again, they missed. One Russian ship, the Gilyak, came up with a brilliant solution to this obvious problem. They turned a spotlight on so they could aim better. This led every single Chinese gun in the forest to target them immediately because they were lit up like a fucking Christmas tree, and the Gilyak was promptly sunk.
Like, how do you not think that I'm going to turn on my giant tactical flashlight? I'm going to be completely invisible to my enemy. Like,
this is a brilliant plan. I do not know why our allies did not think this. Their simple European and Japanese brains cannot possibly think of big spotlight.
Everyone is complaining about my armor having a big crosshairs on it. I just think, you know, it encourages good morale and marksmanship in my soldiers.
We will show them the superior illumination of the Russian Empire. Oh God, my insides.
They're trying to light it and to just find out that the soldiers are after drinking all the kerosene.
They probably did.
Yeah.
Then the American ship was put in the front in order to spark an act of war so the Americans could get involved. Did get hit, and its captain decided, I don't want anything to do with this clusterfuck, and simply pulled his ship away without opening fire. This went on until about 4:30 a.m. when first light peaked out, allowing the fleet to get closer and hit the forts again. And this time, it worked. Captain Hattori, the Japanese detachment commander on the shore, decided the only answer to this chaos, this absolute clusterfuckery of a landing party, is a bayonet charge. He and his men ran forward, him leading from the front, sword drawn and screaming, leaving the rest of the landing party behind. Captain Hattori was immediately shot dead.
I was about to say, this dude definitely just immediately got eviscerated. Like, this is the type of thing, like, from a Monty Python sketch, or, like, is something that is so ridiculous. Like, there's no way they actually did that. It would, like, this sort of shit would spark, like, forum wars on, like, weird history forums.
Well, Hattori did die, but his bayonet charge did succeed. It took over the Chinese positions in front of them, and this led to a weird competition between the Brits and the Japanese of who could take more of the Taku forts than the other. And watching the Japanese run forward spurred the British detachment to do the same, letting headlong into cannon to machine gun fire just to make sure they could keep up with their international rivals when it came to the sport of kicking the Chinese in the teeth. And Chinese resistance faded pretty quickly after this. And this is still argued to this day, but according to several eyewitnesses, not the British, but the Japanese, the Russians, and others, the Japanese were the first to tear down a Chinese flag and raise their own, with the Brits rushing to keep up with them and rising one only a few minutes later. But the day goes to the rising sun, unfortunately.
Yes, unfortunately.
I mean, there's no good guys in this landing force at all.
There's no good guys in this story at all.
That's fair. That's true.
Everyone's bad.
I'm suddenly becoming an Empress Dowager defender.
You're gonna put in your Twitter bio, Dowager Hive Rise.
Oh God, that's a different group of people that are weird that I'm unfamiliar with, I'm sure.
Where's my Dow heads at?
Elsewhere down the nearby river, the Russians and the Brits launch an attack of the Chinese fleet of four German-built torpedo boats, because if they left them, obviously they would have a pretty big advantage over the fleet pulled into the shallow waters of the Taku Bay. Now, the Chinese sailors aboard the ships were competent. They were German-trained. They're almost certainly the most competent assets of the entire Chinese Navy in this area. However, they didn't seem to know that there was a war or even a battle going on, or maybe they simply wanted no part of it, because even after getting, you know, a shot across the bow, so to speak, they didn't react and just gave up their ships without a fight. Like, you can have them. We're good. We don't want none of this.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, up until here, the Imperial Court of China was very busy with one thing, bickering with one another over what they were going to do next, and also paralyzing any decision-making process that they would have.
Yeah.
They were still split about helping the Boxers or fighting them, and especially about fighting another war against the Europeans and the Japanese. Remember how many they had already fought, losing every single one of them, proceeding, losing more territory, giving more concessions. It led them directly to where they were sitting right now. So they were like, do we really want to do this again? And not to mention, a lot of Chinese regional military commanders and politicians were actively fighting one another and stealing one another's shit. But the battle at the Taku forts changed that. And this is when the Empress Dowager gave her order for the foreign delegations at Peking to leave the city. That is when that finally happened. So, like, this seemed to be the final step where one side refused to fully commit to the situation that they had gotten themselves into.
Yeah, someone finally blinked.
Yeah, yeah. The saber rattling finally turned real when a whole bunch of, like, random naval commanders decide to invade Tietzen.
Everybody gangs until the Cossacks show up.
After the bombing of the forts, the Boxers within the city did, well, Boxer stuff. And this is specifically within the Chinese city of Tietzen. They began burning and killing anything that wasn't directly tied to the Chinese government. This led to the creation of the so-called Tietzen Volunteers within the foreign settlement, a mix of Europeans and Chinese Christians who, together with a few European sailors and soldiers stationed within them, within the foreign settlement, tried to defend their settlement from the encroaching Chinese army and Boxers. As the chaos within the Chinese city at Tietzen began to bleed over, They knew, like, oh God, that's going to happen here. Now, thankfully for them, the Boxers busied themselves with the normal killing and burning of Chinese converts within that walled city rather than fully attacking the foreign settlement. So it gave them time. Even with that, though, there was only around 2,000 or so volunteers, with a couple dozen soldiers mixed in with a mix match of guns, some field cannons, a couple machine guns. And right outside, there was at least 15,000 soldiers from the Chinese Imperial Army, sort of supported by an unknown number of thousands of boxers. And then they're under the command of Nie Xincheng, a veteran of the Taiping Rebellion and considered one of the best generals in the entire Imperial Army. In short, odds were not good. And the collection of allies within the foreign settlement agreed to fall under the command of a Russian colonel, other than the British, who refused to listen to them and would simply work on their own. Small but weird side note here, unimportant to the rest of our story, but Herbert Hoover, the future U.S. president, and his wife were caught in the middle of all this because he had taken a job with a British engineering firm, which put him firmly in the foreign settlement of Tientsin at the time.
What?
Surprise!
This is just like, you know, the reverse of like British guys working for American companies and somehow happening to be in Darfur when all that stuff that happened.
Yeesh. The Allies and civilians alike quickly began digging in and reinforcing their small walled settlement as Boxers were distracted, torching the Chinese side of things while on the hunt for Christians. The first large-scale attack by the army and the Boxers was against the settlement's railway station, which was held by Russian soldiers. The Russians, unlike anyone else, had not built any defenses at all. Instead, they chose to simply fight out in a fighting line in the open, like it was the Civil War in the United States, or like the Napoleonic Wars nearly 100 years before. This is described by a British officer as, quote, exceedingly stupid.
Yeah, fucking sounds like it, to be honest.
We have no need to take cover from Chinese guns. We can simply take cover behind Sergei, who's standing in front of me.
Playing your Yu-Gi-Oh card in defense is gay. I only play my cards in attack mode, face up.
Fuck you.
You have activated my trap card, Yugi boy.
You have activated my trap card, which requires me to shoot three of my conscripts for some reason.
I'm just... Now, imagine Russian Maximilian Pegasus.
He's still an oligarch that has an unexplainable amount of money. I don't know.
He's just, fucking Yevgeny Prigozhin.
You seem to enjoy my egg salad, Yugi boy.
Well, get on my personal plane for our trip.
Thousands of Chinese soldiers and boxers charged towards the Russians, who nearly broke, and since the location of the railway station was isolated across a small river from the rest of the Allies, they were nearly impossible to reinforce. That was until some British soldiers, working with some Chinese volunteers, quickly constructed a makeshift bridge out of tied-together boats so they could run across the river and help them.
They're doing Assassin's Creed Black Flag shit.
Rapidly building Fortnite bridges through the sky in order to get to the Russians.
The Boxers are just like, no, we agreed to play no build mode. This is cheating.
God damn it, the British keep bunny hopping across their new bridge. This is bullshit.
There's just some like 12-year-old soldier who's doing like trick shots and building, and it's like, wow, that bridge went up in 4 seconds. What the fuck is going on? And you just see Peter Griffin flying through the sky.
Some Chinese soldiers like, man, we got to retreat. Some 12-year-old named like Limpant Chattington just 360 no-scoped our commander.
There's just some fucking Cossack guy dressed up like Goku running towards them menacingly.
Now, when an attack hit the sector being defended by Germans, their officer constantly wired to the rest of the defenders that they needed reinforcements or to be overrun immediately. However, when the Japanese, the Brits, whoever, ran over to help them, they found that they were barely being attacked at all. This happened so many times that the Germans were eventually given the boy who cried wolf treatment, and people simply stopped answering their pleas for help. The attack was held off, and the settlement fell into a rotation of digging in and keeping watch. The civilians would work in hospitals, dig fighting positions, and cook, while the soldiers, sailors, and armed volunteers would keep watch and wait for the next attack. There's even little cleaning details to sweep up all the spent shell casings, which is honestly quite delightful. That's the job I would sign up for. Like, man, they're going to be gunning for you guys in the trenches. I'm over here with my broom. Y'all are fucking stupid. Though I don't mean to frame this as everybody within this settlement suddenly bonded together by the rigors of conflict or any of that Hollywood bullshit, the Europeans and the Japanese fucking hated the Chinese civilians, of which there were thousands of. They didn't trust them whatsoever, despite the fact they were much more liable to be murdered on the spot by boxers than the foreigners were. Chinese civilians seen walking around without a European escort were liable to be shot on sight for spying without any evidence. Some Europeans tried to push back on this, but the overwhelming opinion was they were not to be trusted and it was better to shoot them than to be sorry for it. In reality, the Chinese within the walls of the settlement lived like slaves at the mercy of jumpy, paranoid European and Japanese soldiers, all while Chinese shells rained down on them from all around, around the clock, to the extent that it caused several people to drop dead from heart attacks from the shock of it all. And this bombardment probably would have wiped the Allies off the map if it wasn't for one small thing. The Chinese had fucked it up. Between the manufacture and supply of someone within the Chinese logistical network badly botched their job. Either they didn't build the artillery shells correctly or they didn't store them right, because the vast majority of the shells being fired at the Tientsin foreign settlement just didn't explode. So the Allies sat there as these things just plopped down from the sky, virtually harmless unless they were hit directly. And the Chinese gun crew's skill was actually excellent. And it was noted by the Europeans that they were too good, to the point that rumors began to spread that the Chinese had captured Russian gun crews and forced them at gunpoint to man their artillery. But they were just well trained, and they would have wiped out the foreign settlement if they didn't just happen to be firing blanks, which, you know, happens to the best of us. The defenders were holding the army and the boxers off, and while their food and water supplies were pretty much endless, their ammo was not, and they're rapidly running low. The Russian colonel in charge said that they'd almost certainly be overwhelmed if the army and the boxers attacked them simultaneously from all fronts, because they did have them surrounded, but for some reason, they just never did. On June 17th, they'd lost all contact with the captured Taku forts and the fleets that held them, and could get no support whatsoever. But that would soon change. One British kid, who's intermittently said is either between 14 and 17 years old, and a few Cossacks decided, fuck it, and rode out in the middle of the night trying to make for the forts, which, despite not being far away, were very well behind enemy lines now. They made it through and got word to the Allied forces what was going on there, and, you know, they had found out that the Allied forces within the Taku area had not moved because they legitimately had no idea what was going on in the settlement. Newly reinforced with hundreds of British soldiers coming from Hong Kong, American sailors, Marines, and soldiers from the Philippines, and a huge number of Russians from Port Arthur, the strange commander democracy of the Taku forts ordered 2,000 men to go and relieve the settlement on June 23rd. Among them was one U.S. Marine, Smedley Butler, who most listeners probably know from exactly one thing he said that one time, and he would eventually go on to be awarded not one, but fucking two medals of honor, only one of 19 people to ever be dripped out in such a way.
Smedley Butler, American military cryptid?
Kind of, honestly. Like, he, up until this war and into World War One, of course, like, he pops up in every conflict, you know, with the American banana wars in Central and Latin America and the Philippines war. He just pops up to do some shit that should only happen in video games.
Yeah, yeah.
This force walked into the settlement virtually unopposed as the boxers and the Imperial Chinese Army watched on. 3 days later, all this is going on. The remains of Seymour's expedition and their Cossack saviors marched into all of this. They believed they were retreating towards Tientsin, like, oh, thank God, we're back. And as they get there, like, everything's on fire. It's constantly being hit with, like, dud artillery rounds. There's dead bodies everywhere. And it's like, fuck.
At first, I thought I was back, but I realized it's now over.
Yeah. Now, with around 6,000 soldiers all packed in and still being shelled, the Allies knew they would have to assault the walled Chinese part of Tientsin to to break the siege. No small task, as the high walls were thick and well defended by thousands of Chinese soldiers, armed with machine guns, cannons, and led by the best commander in the Imperial Chinese Army. What would happen next would become the most important battle of the Boxer Rebellion. And that is where we'll pick up next time on part 4.
Woo! Oh, it's going to get so fucking miserable, Joe.
We have yet to breach the topic. How do you feel 3 parts into the rebellion? Anything like surprise you didn't see coming?
It's a little bit like a Marvel crossover movie. Like Herbert Hoover's showed up, Smedley Butler's there. Like there's loads of Cossacks. It's like, when's Black Panther going to show up?
Oh, Wakanda is not involved in this conflict. They were neutral on the subject.
Yeah, fair.
I mean, they had a lot of British imperialism to fight elsewhere at the time. I have to say, like, researching this, I was really surprised. So far, I should say, because this will not be the case in parts 4 and 5. So far, the kind of seamless teamwork that the allied countries had with one another was astounding. Especially because, like, remember what era we're talking about. All of these countries had fought one another within living memory. Some of them only a few years before. The Japanese and the Russians would be killing each other in a few years' time. On top of all of the other imperial bickering they have with one another. Like, France and Germany are on the same side despite the Franco-Prussian War literally just happening.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of astounding. And I promise you it will not work this well the next 2 parts.
Fuck.
It all goes to complete shit.
Hate when that happens.
Tom, thank you so much for joining me here 3 parts deep into the Boxer Rebellion. You have another podcast. Plug that podcast.
Listen to Beneath Skin, the show about the history of everything told through the history of tattooing. Don't know what episodes we'll be putting out when this episode comes out, but if you enjoy history like this and how it connects to like weird guys and weird history, check out my show, and also check out Glue Factory, a video comedy podcast from some of the minds behind Trash Future. There's incredible bits, incredible jokes, goofs, gaffs, including, is it illegal to bring a suitcase full of piss through an airport?
How do you feel? Is it like baggies that fill up the suitcase, or is this like a watertight suitcase?
I'd assume a watertight suitcase.
I mean, but you fill up one side of the suitcase with piss and you unzip it, the piss is just going to spill right out.
Man, this is for people smarter than me to figure out.
Fluid scientists, urologists, get on the case.
Yeah.
This is the only podcast that I host. If you like what we do here, consider supporting us via Patreon. You make everything we do here possible. Just $5 gets you almost 6 years of bonus content, bonus series, new video series. It gets you every episode early, gets you access to our Discord community, gets you first dibs on new merch and live show tickets when they hit. And leave us a review on wherever it is you listen to podcasts. It helps us immensely. And if you like military science fiction, consider buying my books. I have 2 new books out. Check the show notes and follow the links, and you can get them through Amazon, through wherever it is you get your books. And until next time, don't stumble upon random desert fortresses.